Hello, you're listening to Laser Graves, a podcast where we dig up movies, music, books, and events from the 80s and discuss how rad they were. Welcome back to another episode of Laser Graves. I'm your co-host, E.K. Wimmer.
Hi, I'm your other co-host, Mariah Rose Wimmer, also known as Lord of the Dogs.
Lord of the Dogs just had a birthday.
I did.
Yeah, that was good. We posted on our social media site, if you're following us. If not, you should be. We're shaming you. We posted an old throwback photo that we said we were going to post, man, several episodes ago, and we just kind of spaced it out. I don't even know if it's the same photo shoot now that I'm thinking about it. A random futuristic photo of you that we did from a random future party. I don't even think it was... No, maybe that was an 80s party. I don't even know at this point. No, it was future party.
That was pre-children, that one.
Definitely. You can tell.
Yeah. There's a lot of bubble wrap.
That was pretty fun.
A lot of bubble wrap.
Yeah, so that was good. You had your birthday.
I got a card made out to Lord of the Dogs.
You did. That was nice.
I know. So that's why I brought it back.
That's like birthday card / fan mail.
Well, just really from a friend. But but I feel like once you receive mail as Lord of the Dogs, it's official.
That's right.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah, I'll take it.
Okay.
So this week's going to be good. We are giving you guys a break because the last few books we've done have been children's books.
Teenager books. I think that's perhaps even worse.
Yeah, they're really fun. But we decided to go back in, not quite iVampire territory, but... Well,
I don't think you can. I think that territory exists in its own
cloud. Yeah, that's true. But this week we're doing a book and it'll be... a bit to get through, but I think it'll be fun.
I don't think it'll be a bit to get through.
It's yeah, I guess not. It's just
easy,
not
breezy.
It's not a little 12-year-old exploring, a haunted house. So, but before we get started, I guess we should check in. Any thrift store finds this week?
No,
nothing.
I don't think I thrifted.
You went to the thrift store.
Well, yeah, but I just kind of wandered. Do you ever do that?
No,
I feel like you have focus. You're like, I'm looking for 8 different things. I feel like the last few times I've gone into a thrift store, I've just walked around it, like the perimeter, and just touched things.
You're that person.
Yeah, and then I wash my hands afterwards.
Yeah, I don't... buy a whole lot when I go to thrift stores, but I look a lot because that's my favorite part of thrifting, is just looking at all the weird stuff.
Ooh, we should go garage sailing tomorrow.
I keep trying to garage sale. I thought that, you know, now we're in the Southwest, it was going to be this gold mine, but it's just been a crapshoot, except for, maybe we could start also doing garage sale finds of the week, because now that it's kind of summer's coming up, because I had one. Remember, for a buck, I found a replica of the Wilson volleyball to scale, and I put it up on top of my VHS bookshelf, and it looks awesome. Okay, so...
I wouldn't call that a find,
necessarily. I would definitely call it a find. As far as thrift store finds, though, I have a special place in my heart, and I'm not sure why, for 90s creature flicks. The, like, low-budget CGI flicks that are really bad.
Yeah.
They all just jumped on the bandwagon of Anaconda.
What about, like, is this following in the, like, coattails of Arachnophobia?
Maybe. I mean,
does
I don't know.
Does that fall into the same category?
No, because Arachnophobia was, like, a comedy, too, and these are more,
thinking
like...
full drama...
Yeah, and we watched the other night, remember, because I found a copy of Anaconda. I also have Anacondas now, which is a part two, which I'm dying to watch.
It's the sequel? It's not
ripoff? And we watched, so we pulled out Anaconda and we were all excited to watch it. I mean, it delivered in all the right ways, but it was so bad that I don't know why so many films spun off from that. So there's a bunch that we have. We haven't watched Boa yet. We have that now, too.
Oh, my goodness.
But I found one at a thrift store this week that I'm very excited about because I've seen the cover, but I've never seen it, and it's called Komodo.
Oh, yeah, I've seen the cover.
Yeah, so...
So it's about Komodo dragons?
I'm assuming.
They scare me, though.
Yeah, so maybe it'll be fun. And then my only other big find was a cassette tape by Gwar. I've never in my life found Gwar on cassette, CD, vinyl, ever.
Yeah.
This is the first thing I've ever found by Gwar. So that was pretty fun. I've listened to it like 10 times already.
Have you seen Gwar?
In concert?
Yeah.
No, never. Oh, I've never
you seem like someone who would.
I definitely would if I had the chance.
Like,
I just,
would have already.
Yeah, I just, they never came through when I, where I was living, at, you know, back in the day.
Your time will come.
Yep. But, so there's thrift stores, finds of the week. Let's get to it, because we've got a lot to get through. It's a full book. I mean, it's a novel, but it's a collection of short stories. So this week we are talking about 1985... The Clive Barker. We're talking about a book he did called The Inhuman Condition. To my knowledge, it's actually part of a series of books that he did between like 2 years called the Books of Blood series, and it was like 6 volumes.
I've read one other one, I think, from this series where I don't remember what book it was, but it was a bunch of people forming their bodies into a human wheel.
Oh, weird. This is, I think, volume 4, if I'm not mistaken.
It doesn't say on the book. Let me rifle through some papers while you speak.
Yeah, go ahead and do that. I don't...
That was me rifling.
I don't know because, in all honesty, I'm a very big Clive Barker fan for his movies, and I knew he was an author, but this is the first thing I've ever read by Clive Barker, and so I'm not well-versed on it. I know you've read Clive Barker in the past.
Yeah, right? I've read a few, but I think the only one of the Books of Blood, I don't really know. But I did read one where it was a series of shorts, but the only one I really recall is the Human Bloody Wheel.
We'll have to figure out what that was.
Yep.
But this is 1985. There's 5 short stories in this one called... this whole volume is called The Inhuman Condition. It's pretty interesting because it predates his films. You know, it predates Hellraiser, Nightbreed, Candyman. Like,
did you know him as a writer first or only as a filmmaker?
Well, I knew Clive Barker for Hellraiser. Hellraiser is one of my all-time favorite films.
That was your first Clive introduction?
Yeah, that was my first... I big horror fan growing up, but Hellraiser was one that really set itself apart, and I was like, well, this is something different. So... Hellraiser's always been a special franchise to me, even though it sucked for the most part. But I really still... We just watched it. What was that last one called? I can't remember. Just came out.
Hellraiser 9000 and they race cars.
I didn't mind it. Doug Bradley wasn't Pinhead, but it was still pretty good. But that's how I know Clive Barker. Also, what did you... Lord of Illusion. Like, all these... He's done so many things. But I knew he was an author. That's what's weird. I knew he wrote these.
Mm-hmm.
And I think just early on, maybe I had read an interview or heard something from him, but it was always known, at least for me. I've always known that he was an author because he was an author first. He was a published author before he started making films.
Well, and he had to be kind of famous because it was always Clive Barker's Lord of Illusions or whatever. So he had a name, sort of like you would say Stephen King's The Stand or whatever. Why did I choose The Stand? Whatever.
I don't know.
Okay.
So, but I knew he was an author, and that's why I think I was excited to read this, not only because it would change things up and not be a tweenage novel for our, you know, ghost novel for our podcast, but also...
Whatever. Those are good.
I wanted to see what his writing was like, and it is pretty close to what I expected.
Is it?
Yeah, especially the first two are much more like... much more in the vein of Hellraiser and Nightbreed and stuff like that. The third one really was out of left field for me. We'll get to that.
Yeah, you get to lead that conversation.
I do, yeah. But let's get started because I don't think... I mean, unless you need a little background, he's a British author and filmmaker and
producer. Do you read when you know the author is British? Do you, in your mind, read his books with a British accent?
A little bit, because the first story that you're going to be discussing takes place in England, and so I kind of had a whole British accent to all the characters when I was reading it. But yeah, he's, you know, he's in his mid-60s now, and he's got a very prolific career, so it's fun to go back and revisit and see where his where he got his start. And, you know, we'll discuss it. I think maybe at the end we could give a little bit of an opinion about what we think, but
let's get into it.
You're gonna kick it off, right?
Yeah, with the first so we have five short stories. The Inhuman Condition is the first one, and I'll just give you sort of a general overview, and we can kind of talk about it as we go. I think we're going to kind of freeform this as we go through. Okay, so The Inhuman Condition starts with a bunch of hooligans, and I didn't really realize it was hooligans because it's like they're in a tunnel, and I was kind of thinking it was wartime almost. Like,
did you think they were hooligans? I thought they were youths.
Youths.
No. Well,
those youths in that tunnel. For some reason, I was like immediately drawn to wartime, but it's not actually what's happening at all. You're furrowing your brow, so clearly you didn't go there.
I wouldn't even put that.
When I hear tunnel and I'm thinking, I don't know what I was thinking. Anyway, no, it has nothing to do with anything, so probably not worth mentioning, but that's where I was at. So there are a bunch of hooligans, and they come across a homeless man who is relieving himself in the tunnel, in this tunnel that they're all in. And I immediately imagined that he was pooping.
You went straight to it. Huh?
Just like he's definitely taking a dump right there in that tunnel.
Do you remember that in Living Color skit with, was it Damon Wayans who was the bum who carried around
the turd?
The turd in a jar. Yeah.
Yes, that was exactly what I imagined. Anyway, so he's relieving himself, probably just peeing, but maybe you can envision him pooping. And we discover that the homeless man is named Pope. The boys, whose names I'll just kind of briefly touch on, they're Brendan, Red, Katso, and then Carney.
Yeah, Red is the leader.
Yeah, I mean, they're just...
Brandon's the, like, insane kind of one. Katso's the indifferent one. And I have Carney's kind of the youngest and pretty uncertain.
He's like a teenager, I think. So they decide they're going to beat up Pope. So I guess, like, Red... Sees Red. I don't know. Maybe that's where he got his name.
Oh, okay.
So he violently attacks this old man. And there's like a notion that Carney maybe isn't comfortable with this violence, but he goes along with it because he knows he'll take it if he speaks up against these guys beating up a homeless man. So they like tell him, you got to look through the homeless guy's stuff, see if there's anything worth taking, like his booze or whatever.
That's kind of what they're mainly after, right? Where the booze.
Like robbing him, yeah.
Well, but they were like, you know, we know you have
oh, can you even imagine being like, let's take that homeless man's liquor.
Ugh. Yeah, let's just like drink hepatitis.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, you're going to get scabies for sure. Can you get scabies through drinking?
I don't think that was the best choice.
Whatever. Don't drink scabies. Don't do it.
There's a pirate public service announcement.
Never.
Don't get the scabies from the bums.
Never again.
All right.
So anyway, he's looking through, and he finds a knotted rope, and he kind of shoves it secretly in his pocket. It's got three knots on it that I guess tickle his fancy.
I had a hard time getting into this at first because the obsession in which he wants to untie these knots made zero sense to me. Okay. I was like, is this a simple folk here? But I couldn't tell. And then it made way more sense as the story went on.
Yeah. Also, I immediately thought of this book that I read when I was a kid called Maniac McGee. And I don't remember the whole story, but at one point this kid like solves a knot riddle. And so he like is tugging and pulling and unties this knot. And when I was little, after reading Maniac McGee, I would tie big knots and untie them.
Wow.
I mean, it's not something I still do, to be clear.
I kind of prided myself as a kid on being able to untie knots that most kids couldn't. Like, not like shoelace things. You know how just
yeah.
strings would get into, like yo-yos or whatever.
Yeah.
I was always one who was very good at getting it untied. Still to this day, our kids bring us stuff all the time, and I'm like, yeah, sure, I'll just undo it.
Yeah, let me
and
do
I
that.
And I really enjoy it, and I'm good at it. So now that I'm thinking about it...
It's satisfying.
It's a good premise. Yeah. Let's continue. Mm-hmm.
Think about like when you get like a necklace chain and you have to use like a needle.
Those are the big ones, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
That's like popping a zit kind of... It feels good. Whatever.
Okay.
Whatever. So. There are others.
The story could have gone a different way if you were...
Whatever. Okay, so Carney finds a knotted rope, quickly puts in his pocket, and he uses a term a couple times. He says, with eager hands. I dislike the term eager hands. Don't say eager hands. Hands should never be eager. Anyway, I was disturbed. So his eager hands grab the knotted rope.
Wait, you just said don't use the term eager hands and then chose to use the term eager
hands. I'm probably going to say eager hands forever now. Anyway, later, his friends... he goes home first. And he is like, I'm going to get these knots. And mm-hmm. he becomes obsessed. It's like time has no meaning. He is letting his friendship slide. He's just going to get the knots. And they're really hard at first. But his friends kind of pull him out and they're like, dude, you need to come be the lookout while we rob a house. And he realizes he has to, I guess. So he goes with them. His only job is to be the lookout while they break into a house and rob it. And it's a whole lot of setup for this robbery, but it really isn't important to the story. And he's looking out while they're robbing, but he's like, wait, I've got my knots with me. And so he's right there. His fingers are eager, almost as eager as his hands.
Well, it gives the impression that the knots in his pocket are kind of like beckoning him.
They're tickling his fingers. They're eager to be in his hands.
Yeah.
Okay. So anyway, there's a knot to hand reunion that happens here whilst there's a robbery happening. So he's kind of like letting his vigil slide here as the lookout and instead focuses on the trance inducing knots.
Yeah, because when they're like, are you doing a good job paying attention? He's like, yeah, not. Wow, thanks for laughing at that.
I wasn't enthusiastic.
You just never know.
Yeah, I don't know. Okay, so while he's waiting, he's working the first knot, and then something, like he breaks it out, and something leaps out, and it's growing as it leaps out.
Well, and the knot glows, too. It, like, mm-hmm. gives off this light as it's becoming undone.
Yeah, it's a special knot, and something special comes out of it, but he doesn't get a good look at it. But this is all kind of happening simultaneously. The friends are making their break from a house. They're getting spotted by the coppers. They're making a run for it. And Red and, was it Brendan, take off. They just, like, later and run. Mm-hmm. And then stupid Carney is like, where are my knots? What's happening? And he's kind of like lingering around confused. So Katso, the other friend, comes back for him and kind of helps him to leave. But then Katso looks up and sees something that's like muddy and wet in the trees and has a stinky, earthy smell.
Yeah, it's creepy.
It scares him and he bolts. And he's so scared by what he has seen that he runs down the path and out. Oh, go ahead.
Well, it lifts him into the tree.
Yeah, it pulls
and
him up.
Drops him. Mm-hmm. Like, it actually interacts with him. It's yes. Not, he doesn't
not
just
with
see it.
Not with Carney. Carney's...
No, Katso. The thing in the tree, like,
Carney's
picks him
back
up, and he screams, and then he drops down, and mm-hmm. that's what makes him bolt, because it's, like, touched him now, and he's freaking out.
And so he freaks out and runs straight into oncoming traffic.
Yeah,
and
did you see that coming?
Yeah.
It's like, whoa.
Well, it was all this, like, whoa, he's not looking, he's running, and yeah.
Yeah.
So he gets hit. He's roadkill. Oh, is it mean to refer to a human as roadkill?
Not at all.
Okay.
It's what it is.
So he's roadkill, and he dies. Carney...
Old roadkill Katso.
So Carney's like, that sucks for sure, but these knots anyway. So he goes back to working out the knots. Like, that's what he wants to do. And he still has to go to the funeral because you got to keep up appearances between knot sessions.
Does Carney have a Cockney accent? Is he like,
yeah.
Oh, hey, it's bad that me mate went and ran in the forest and then he went and got hit by the truck and it's the brakes, but I've got to play with me knots.
Well, it's like a old, but I like me knots.
Oh, he's a teenager.
He's 17.
Oh, you see the old pony when he got hit by the... I just imagine he's got a really thick accent.
Yes, they all... I feel like it's Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels accents.
Oh, definitely,
but like,
all of them, because they're
teenagers.
Just like robbing and beating up people. Yep. Yeah.
So, Carney, he's back at the knots, but still has to go to this darn funeral. It's at the crematorium, which is unusual, I suppose, for a book to make note of that. Anyway, so Carney goes to that, and afterwards, the homeless man, Pope, approaches him. And he's like, where are my knots? Or me knots?
Yeah. He's like, you little kid, you remember me, don't you? You took a fancy to me when I was taking a turn in the tunnel. Where are me knots?
What? Oh my gosh. Okay. So, yep, Pope approaches him. He wants his knots back. And Carney's like, nah.
Nobody touches me nuts. Get your hands off me nuts.
The English accent is very deceiving.
Mm. Okay. And then Pope gets real scary. He's starting to get pushy and like start a fight with Carney to like take the knots back. But then Red, the guy who initially beat up Pope, comes back and rescues Carney. And in the scuffle, the knots are lost.
Mm-hmm.
And
he's lost his knots.
He's lost his knots. And Carney thinks that Pope got him. But actually, it was Red's girlfriend who was lingering around. She snatched up the knots.
Mm-hmm.
Can you even imagine just like seeing knots and being like, I got to take those with me?
Yeah.
Eric and I want to start a business where we sell pistachios and call it D's Nuts.
Do you remember that sign when we were going to college and it was, it wasn't D's Nuts. It was
something similar and that's
and
what we
said,
decided.
Kissed by the sun. Remember that was their motto?
Well, this knot was not kissed by the sun. Instead, it was fondled by the hands of Red's girlfriend. She takes it home, and her eager hands get to work, and she lets out another, what I'm going to call a knot baby. They're all knot babies.
She undid that knot way faster, by
the
way.
Well, but to be fair, Carney had been working on it since his pal died.
Carney's like, I loosened it up.
I loosened it for you. So she
can't be taking the credit for that knot. I was working on it for days.
She got the knot out, and then Red comes home, and he was looking for his lady friend and can't find her, and then the knot baby kills him, attacks him and kills him, and then she skedaddles. She doesn't really want anything more to do with either the knots or the knot creature she unleashed. But Carney comes around and he like stumbles upon the scene at Red's house of dead Red and the knot Red's dead and finds the knot baby and it looks like a flayed monkey that's like bloody and meaty and simian.
It's really gross. And this is when you realize that the cord holds in these, like, kind of demons of some sort.
Yeah, they're like sloppy, half-created things.
As I was reading this, so this is my very first Clive Barker book, and this is the first short story in the book, and I'm already like, whoa, this is...
What's happening?
It's kind of interesting, and it's...
What?
Hey, what's going on here? What's this Clive Barker book all about?
I was really into it right away. I thought it was so weird.
It's weird. Okay, so Carney talks to this weird monkey thing and then decides to retreat. And he also gets his knots back. He goes home and he gets a phone call, and it's his friend Brendan. So two out of four of them are dead. Red and Katzo are dead. It's only Carney and Brendan.
Flatso Katzo?
Oh, yes. And dead Red. And so it's Brendan, which there's nothing fun to be done with his name.
Oh, we'll figure it out. I bet it'll come to us in a moment of clarity.
So Brendan has been kidnapped, and he calls Carney and's like, "Pope got me, bro. Come and save me, babe." And so Pope's just really trying to lure Carney and the knots back, and he calls him to a wrecking yard. Carney goes to this wrecking yard, which apparently Pope has turned into some sort of crazy maze. And he's like, "This is my place."
Yeah, and he looks and he's like, "He'll now be called Indian Brendan."
You did it. I'm so proud of you.
Yeah.
Okay. I can't think. I've got to read. He goes, Carney. Pope demands, like, "Give me that third knot now.
Yeah.
Do it, or I'm going to kill Brendan." And Carney's like, "Well, on the one hand, my friend's life. On the other hand, this bitchin' knot that I've almost got."
Yeah, totally.
Figured out.
I'm not willing to give it up.
Oh, you're not?
Mm-mm.
Okay. Then there's,
I feel like this is going to be the dumbest episode we've ever recorded already. It's filled with bad puns.
It's going to be the
bad accents.
This is it. This is the pivotal episode.
This is the episode that's going to break, and everybody's going to be like, "Hey, I've heard. Let's check it out now. We've been hearing about this podcast," and this will be the introduction, and they'll be like, pass.
Hard pass.
Hard pass.
Okay, so he gets the knot undone. There's like a chase. Brendan gets killed. Brendan Dunn got killed.
Why are you... Save the southern accent for a few stories from now.
Okay. So Pope kills Brendan, and Carney's like running off, and he's trying to untie this knot as he like... wiggles around a weird wrecking yard that's been turned into a maze by a crazy tunnel pooping homeless man.
Yeah, it got weird at the
end. It got super weird, and I'm going to just kind of gloss past this. He gets this knot, the final knot, untied, and this is an actual knot baby. It's like a half-formed, like, mutant knot baby. And then the other two knotties come.
Yeah.
They
Voltron it up.
I have it in my notes. They Voltron.
Yeah, totally.
And so all three Naughties come together and Voltron into one. And Pope grabs Carney as, like, protection from this, like, triple threat knot man, who we learn is Pope's brother.
Right. That was a strange reveal.
Yeah. I mean, who else are you going to put in a knot?
Which made me think of Hellraiser and how... That was a whole brother story, too, where
was
the
it?
Brother was upstairs trying to come back to life, remember? And, then I thought, man.
Does Clive Barker have
a Barker's got some brother issues, yeah.
Oh, or maybe he doesn't, and this was a safe place.
Maybe.
So he wouldn't hurt his sister's feelings. So we learn that Pope has somehow figured out some spells and trapped his brother. We don't know why he doesn't like his brother. But for some reason, he doesn't, and he wants his brother to be trapped in three pieces and knots. Mm-hmm. And this is also where we learn that the knots were actually evolutionary. So, like, from mud to monkey to man.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. Brilliant, right?
I didn't catch any of that.
Okay.
I was too focused on how weird the baby, like, knot thing was.
I know. I imagined it sound like...
It was creepy. Well, it's easy. Okay, so here's one thing that I do appreciate about reading Clive Barker after being so familiar with his movies, is it's easier to imagine the world in which his stories take place. Because I was thinking about Hellraiser 2, Hellbound, when, you know, the doctor gets the weird suction thing on his head and he's in this other world.
Mm-hmm.
And he creates these weird, like, meaty pleasure pain mm-hmm. worlds that...
Did he do Midnight Meat Train?
No, I don't think he did that. I mean, maybe he did. I don't think so.
Okay, never mind.
But he... he creates these worlds so well in his movies that reading his books, I'm like, oh, it's a Clive Barker world. I mean, yeah. It's kind of like a Tim Burton world or a Wes Anderson
Absolutely.
World. Like, Clive Barker really is good about creating this weird world that he has, and, yeah. and all his stories kind of live in them.
Yeah, a lot of, like, body meat qualities.
Yeah, and I imagine everything to be very muted, like blue tones yeah. and like gray tones, and it's really interesting.
Yeah. So in conclusion, Carney escapes while the Knot brother kills
Knot Pope. Brother. The brother's Knot.
Yes, they you know work out their problems. However, but Carney escapes. Along with the notes that he stole from Pope. So he has the spell notes. So you go, ooh, right. what's he going to do with it? But then it's over. But I presume he went out to make, to live a life full of making not babies.
That's right. Everybody's got a talent.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So do you want to lead us into
number
two?
Yeah, that was a long one. But the first two are pretty long. And the last yeah. one's kind of long, too.
Well, I have the last one down pretty short.
Yeah, so, but I knew we were going to spend a little bit of time on these first two, so yeah. bear with us. The next one is called, and I'll take the lead on this, The Body Politic,
mm-hmm.
which was actually turned into a movie. It was adapted.
Really?
Yeah, well, it's kind of interesting. It was adapted along with a Stephen King short into a movie called Quicksilver Highway.
Oh, I've heard of it.
Yeah, and you know who directed it? Mick Garris, the host of Postmortem, the podcast that I've been listening to like nonstop.
Interesting.
Yeah, actually, I wrote him the other day, and he wrote me back.
What did he say? BFFs?
Yeah, he said no. He was really nice, but I was just...
Okay.
Sending him a little note about his podcast, because it's seriously one of the best podcasts I've ever listened to. Is if you're into the film horror film industry, and if you work in it or want to, this is the podcast to listen to, because he interviews all these directors and filmmakers mm-hmm. and composers and stuff that work in the horror industry.
I mean, I'm not interested in working in that industry at all, but I've listened to a couple episodes, and they're really interesting.
They're really good. So Mick Garris, the host, is one who directed the Quicksilver Highway, but The Body Politic was adapted in that film, which I thought was really interesting, especially when we're about to talk about what the story's
yeah,
about.
Yeah, that is
a really
interesting.
Weird one.
It's one of those weird, like, universe tie-ins where everything just kind of...
Yeah, it's a small world,
and
the horror world is very small, too, but... So, The Body Politic is the second story in this anthology, and it follows a guy named Charlie, who's this 41-year-old man. He's got sore hands. They fidget a lot at night when he sleeps.
So, instead of restless leg syndrome, he has restless hand syndrome.
Yeah, definitely. Oh, boy, does he.
Oh, watch out.
Oh, don't you know. And so, he works in a boxing factory, and he thinks maybe that's why they're bothering him.
So, the boxing factory, obviously, he's just punching.
he's actually boxing.
He's got gloves, and he just boxes. Yes. Punches products into boxes.
Do you remember when your brother worked for UPS?
Uh-huh.
And we made him business cards because he just dealt with all the boxes, and his title was package handler. And we made him business cards that said
cool.
professional package handler. I'll handle your package with love and care. I like that he's the younger brother and we're the one making those business cards.
He was like 20 and we're in our 30s with
that
children.
Was great. Oh, whatever. Life's for living. And so he's kind of slipping into madness, though, is what we get the sense of right away. His hands know he's going crazy. And this is, it jumps in pretty quick that his mm-hmm. hands are talking to each other. Like
yeah.
at night.
They're communicating.
They communicate. They like crawl up on his chest and have like these little interactions.
While he's in a full sleep.
Yes. And then we find out pretty quickly that they're plotting to kill him and be free. They want to be removed from the body and like go on this rampage of like building up a revolution to mm-hmm. remove themselves, which is right away on this story. I was like, what the hell am I reading? It was really interesting. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know how he was going to pull it off.
He does.
He does. So Charlie goes to see a therapist and remembers his father's hands as he laid in his casket. And so he thinks the therapist is like, this is why you're obsessed with your hands. Mm-hmm. And doesn't think that there's anything more to it. And then one night after, like, some time with his lady, they're sitting there in bed.
Yeah, that's kind of weird. The hands
are
involved in that process, but they're compliant with his wishes while he's awake.
Yeah, it's like a foursome without his knowledge.
Yeah, it's icky.
So afterwards, he and his wife, Ellen, they're laying in bed, and Charlie is sleeping, and she notices his hands are talking to each other. They're like kind of arguing. I'm doing it with my hands right now because that's the way to do it.
Act it out.
All I could think, okay, this whole entire short story, all I could think was, what's his name? Thang or whatever
the
Adam's family. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's all
Thing.
I could do. But it's very much the same. And I wonder, if there was any correlation between that. But there's a lot of like gesturing with the fingers and sniffing with the fingers. And
ugh, sniffing.
The sniffing's really gross.
No sniffing. Fingers don't have noses.
But she notices it. And then all of a sudden they notice her noticing them and start to choke her while Charlie's sleeping. Mm-hmm. And he's having this weird dream of being like a slave choking the master,
mm-hmm.
but wakes up to no control over his hands, choking his wife and killing her.
That's unfortunate.
It's really sad. And it's a really creepy scene. This whole story was actually kind of disturbing. He begs them and they drop her. There's a really cool quote in here, or I guess it wouldn't be a quote, but it would be like a line, a passage that I loved. And this is like quintessential Clive Barker, because what I loved about Hellraiser was, especially in the first one, the Cenobites and Pinhead didn't have a lot of lines, but what they did say, it was always like pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
You could tell he was a writer.
Deep revelations.
Yeah. And, there's this line in here when he's begging them and they drop her, and Clive Barker describes her as a pretty sack of death.
Eck.
That's such a Clive Barkerism, but I love it too. It's like perfectly descriptive.
Well, I mean,
I don't know. I thought it was really, really cool. It also reminds me of, from this point on, now that the like hands have taken control of him and are killing people or killing his wife. Do you remember that movie Body Parts?
Vaguely.
It's about this, it's about a serial killer whose arm is sewn onto a man.
Yeah, it's like a serial killer's arm.
Yeah,
maybe?
And then it's transplanted, and then all of a sudden the man starts to like become evil.
There's another one similar that is the same thing, where a woman gets serial killer's eyeballs.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was just thinking of Body Parts with the serial killer arm, but it was kind of similar.
Yeah.
So Charlie runs to his kitchen to call the doctor, but his hands won't let him dial. And it's kind of like an episode of The Twilight Zone. I really loved this whole scene where they like
for sure
grab on and bang his head like against the, like they're trying to knock him out basically so that he can't call. So his hands are controlling him.
Yeah. As I read this part, did you like, cause I kept thinking like, what would I do if I didn't have control of my own hands?
How would you stop them?
Yeah, because you really rely on those bad boys.
It was weird. There is a weird scene in here that I was like, this is the only part of the short story. I was like, I don't know if I would have done that. But his left hand reaches down and squeezes his testicles to the point of bleeding. And I get it, because for the story, he's trying to like debilitate the body. Like the hands are trying to like take down the body to stop him from calling the doctor.
But that's also quite rude, if you think about it.
It is.
If you know that the hands are independently like working, what are the testicles doing? Maybe they're like, hey,
maybe
stop.
They're like, you're gonna get it when we're severed off.
And we're coming after you. It's
they're
a hand
just
testicle
sing
war.
In castrati voice. They're gonna be like, we're getting you. Now that we're free from the body. So
it's just a bunch of like Justin Timberlakes and Freddie Mercury voices.
But what's interesting is they squeeze him till he bleeds, and then he falls and hits his head. And then this, I love this part, the hands are grabbing the carpet and dragging him across the floor.
Yeah.
Oh, so creepy. The right severs off the left. So So we're clear. The right is like the
leader.
The leader.
Yeah.
And the left is kind of like the grunt worker. He's going to gather up the army. So the right severs off the left and is like, you'll come back for me, because the cops bust in. Left goes out on an adventure outside, like Adam's Family style. Like, mm-hmm. I imagined it running and then sliding around the corner. Like,
totally.
Adam's Family.
Absolutely. Same thing.
Cops take Charlie in an ambulance, and then we flash to a totally different scene where we're going to a YMCA, where Left is walking into the front of a YMCA.
Mm-hmm.
There's a like a racist 62-year-old there.
Yeah, it doesn't really matter.
It doesn't matter. But, well, it does matter, because a lot of the YMCA kids that are upstairs are like troubled youth and drunks and homeless.
No. There's like a construction worker. There's a police officer. There's a Native American.
Well, a lot of them are African American, and that's why they were setting him up to be a racist.
Making a YMCA joke.
It's oh, I didn't even catch it. Good one.
Thank you.
Okay, so the security guard is this like racist guy, and Left walks up to the security guard. Summons the hands of the security guard, and it is gruesome. They like sever their hands off of him.
Yeah, he wakes them up. He's like, hey guys, time's now.
And they're like, it's go time. And now there's three hands running around, and it's really gross.
Ugh.
Then the hands go upstairs, and all the guys are sleeping in the YMCA, and a young man named Boswell is in the bathroom.
Boswell.
He sees everyone hacking off their hands. He like looks out because he hears a commotion. And it's this like a madhouse where everybody's like hacking off their hands and killing themselves. It's really gross.
That's unsettling.
He runs and locks the door, and two hands get in. He stabs one of them on the wall, like impales it.
Ugh.
And crushes another with his foot, and then escapes out the window and takes off.
Also,
it's really weird.
It's super weird, but this is also where we learn Boswell's hands aren't like, they're not going to go against him. They're cool with just staying attached.
Yeah, for some reason they don't betray him.
I think
we'll find out later.
I think it's good, though, because you get a sense that the hands have minds of their own.
Yeah, they're selectively choosing to be a part of this uprising.
Mm-hmm.
We go back to Charlie, who wakes up in the hospital and confesses to the crime of strangling his wife. And the cops were like, no, 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 you're a victim. Somebody attacked you and cut off your hand and killed your wife. And he's like, no, you don't get it. And they are not understanding why he would do that.
Well, can you even like fathom going, okay, so...
Yeah, so explain that.
You woke up to your hand strangling your wife and you cut one of them off?
Yeah. Okay. Then there's a brief scene that's not related, but it's kind of the army on the march, where this army of hands overtake a woman on the highway. They're like going down the road.
I thought of it like a plague of toads. Did you?
I thought of it like a plague of tarantulas.
Oh, yeah.
Because my parents, my dad told me this story one time. Well, my mom has told me it on a different occasion too. I've heard it several times throughout my life, where they were taking a road trip when they were young and in love. They had a motorcycle and they would just kind of road trip. And my mom told me the story that one time they were just driving down this long kind of desert highway. I think they were going through New Mexico because they were coming back to visit her parents. And she said it kind of looked like a mirage. The pavement, the black pavement, looked like it was kind of wave-like, like moving. And they thought it was a mirage. So, they're going like 70 miles an hour or whatever. And as they got close, they couldn't stop. And they realized it was a migration of tarantulas in the middle of the Southwest. And they had to kind of drive through it because it had all happened so fast.
Yeah, you can't like slam
on
your brakes.
Yeah, but she said it was
brakes.
Really creepy because the way in which they were moving matched kind of the pavement. And it looked like it was just like a body of...
Like undulating asphalt.
Yeah, it was really creepy. I should incorporate that sometime into a story. But anyway, So that's what I thought about this whole highway scene. Then we go back and the psychiatrist goes to Charlie's house because he did manage to call him, but the psychiatrist like blew him off.
Mm-hmm.
He goes to his house and is killed by the hands. It's a pretty, quick scene and we don't have to really dwell on it. Then the kid, Boswell, that escaped the YMCA. This is a weird scene that caught me off guard. His legs give out and like take over and throw him under a train and sever themselves off.
So all body parts are up for grabs.
Well, now apparently I was so confused by this scene. I was like, wait, why did he just do that? I didn't know if he was trying to commit suicide or what. Then we go back to Charlie. He's escaped his bed and starts to talk to his hands while the other hand and the army look for him. So left is trying to get back to right to sever it off to lead the army.
Yeah, and he's like making deals with
right. Yeah, he's like, look, I'll sever you off if you just let me go and chill out. And then he goes to the garden because the hand's wanting to go out there of the hospital. There's like a little courtyard.
Sure.
He goes out there and finds a doctor hanging in the tree and then looks up. And this was my favorite part of the whole story. He looks up and there are hundreds of hands crawling around in the tree above the hanging doctor.
No.
And they just start dropping down and coming after him. Ugh. Oh, so gross.
I feel like hands are like cats and they always land on their fingertips.
Yeah. Well, because we've watched The Addams Family.
Oh, yeah.
And so they all start to surround him because Wright, he still has Wright on his hand. Mm-hmm. And that's the Messiah, as they describe it.
Yeah.
Or how it's described. And they're like waiting for their thing. And then he gets the
thing.
Oh. And then he gets the idea. He's like looking around, scrambling for an idea. And he sees the roof and he runs up and realizes they're all going to follow because this is their leader now and wherever it goes. So he doesn't have control over his hand, but he has control over his body.
Yeah.
And he starts running up the roof and then he goes to the top of the roof and he jumps off and they all follow suit, like over the top.
Yeah, just hundreds of hands.
And there's just these hands splatting on the bottom.
Ugh, mass suicide. Imagine being the person coming to clean it up.
Yeah. The only part of this whole story that lost me was the very end. I was like, why, Clive, did you write that? It was so stupid.
What was it?
He wrote, there's like this riddle that he's going through and he's like, what is it? The sound of one hand? The sound, and then he's like, what's the sound of one hand clapping? And then jumps off the roof and kills himself.
That was funny.
I was just like, what the, what was the point of any of that?
You know what the sound of one hand clapping is.
I can do
is.
It, ready?
So good.
I know.
Okay.
I always think of that Simpsons episode when he does it. But so then Boswell awakes and he's in the hospital. This is how the story ends. And guess what's standing there? His two legs, independent, staring at him with their like nubs. And this is where it's left is basically like now the legs are independent. And my final note was, good luck with that takeover, because the hands can, like, wield weapons and stuff. The legs, I think, more like that that Chronicles of Narnia scene where there's, like, the one-footed, you know, creatures, like, jumping on the island.
Yeah. That's, Duffelpuds.
Yeah, I'm like, that's not going to be as scary of a takeover.
Well, it would depend. Like, I know people whose feet are, like, atrophied and can't do anything, but I feel like I could do anything with my feet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, there you go. So it depends on the foot.
Yep.
So that is what is it called? The body politic.
Yep. And then the next one is called Revelations.
Revelations. So now we'll work through these pretty quick because we're getting up there in time, but also these stories are a lot shorter.
Yeah.
These first two were much longer. I'll do Revelations. You want me to?
Yeah.
This was, I wasn't a huge fan of this one.
I didn't love this one either.
Here, this is the interesting thing, and maybe we could save it to the end, but I guess we could just talk about it now, is based on the first two, it felt like it was lacking in imagination because
it was real straightforward.
The first two were so bizarre and off the wall, and this one was it was very straightforward. It was fine, but it was not what I would expect from Clive Barker. It's
maybe
what
it's
I would
like
expect from like
a
somebody else.
Like a breather after those two. Yeah. Like, okay.
So let's get into it. It's called Revelations. It's about this story of a woman named Virginia, her husband John, who's a evangelical like preacher, like
he's like a traveling preacher, like a fire and brimstone kind
of
guy.
Like a cult leader, because he's got thousands of people that come to hear
him. Yeah, he
talk.
Travels. I felt sort of it was a Deep South kind of traveling, you know, snake charmer type.
Like a Jim Jones kind of.
Maybe.
Jonestown kind of thing, too. Well, because when he was first getting started, it was that same idea where he was traveling around talking to these large groups.
Because he couldn't find one congregation.
Right. So Virginia, her husband John, who's the preacher, and this guy named Earl, who's like the assistant, is driving. And they're going through Texas. He's like this cult figure. It's raining really hard. As he's like talking to himself, like reciting passages and stuff like that.
kind of like rehearsing and preparing for his gig the next day.
He's traveling through, they say, New Mexico and maybe Arizona and Colorado or something like that. Like, he's going through the Southwest on this mm-hmm. tour where thousands of people come up to hear him talk about fire and brimstone and everything else.
Yep.
It's raining really hard, and his wife wants to get a hotel and stop because she's not feeling it. And finally, he gives in and is like, okay. So they stop at this mm-hmm. roadside kind of dump, you know, this dive out in the middle of nowhere. Uh-huh. And John and Virginia sleep in separate beds, we find out. They've kind of got a strained relationship because he's really dedicated to his preaching. And that she has a lot of anxiety. She's nervous a lot of the time. And so Earl, the assistant, has been like slipping her sleeping pills and stuff like
pills
that.
To deal with her anxiety because her husband won't really let her do anything to manage that anxiety.
Yeah, and he's really controlling. Mm-hmm. And John found out once that Earl had slipped her some and got really mad. So now they've been doing it like on the DL still. Mm-hmm. So then we meet, it shifts focus mm-hmm. to Buck and Sadie, who are this kind of unhappy married couple on their 30-year anniversary. But we find out that they are celebrating their 30-year anniversary in the hotel in which Sadie shot Buck and killed him on their honeymoon.
For being a philanderer.
Yeah, because he's this real creepy dude who just loves sleeping around. And so she pulls out a .38 and blasts him in the chest. And she is then later electrocuted, sent to the chair, mm-hmm. and now they're ghosts, and they're, I guess, deciding they want to try and, like...
Well, it feels like it's an option.
Yeah, they're going to go back 30 years later and try and make amends and see if they can make it work out, I guess.
As I feel like it's supposed to be, like, their ticket to heaven, maybe, and they've been in, like, a purgatory state
or
something.
Yeah, it's like an experimentation.
Who knows?
These ghosts come in. Earl goes to the office to get water for Virginia. So we're back to
so he can dose her.
The three people, yeah. And smiles at this 35-year-old daughter, who's the daughter of the hotel owner. Mm. And they immediately kind of have like a little bit of a thing.
Yep.
Her name's Laura May.
Laura May.
And boy, is it's just hot, sweaty, and sticky out here. And I got a cup of water.
I got to live in my dad's hotel.
And I imagine she's got cut-off jeans and she's got curly bangs.
Curly bangs? So, are they poofy, though?
Oh, they're very poofy. It's the 80s. So Laura May and Earl kind of hit it off a little bit. The next scene, I just wrote, ghosts have drama about their past. I don't care at all.
Yeah, it's pretty boring and not...
Reminds me of Gerald's Game. Like, I don't care when ghosts have
don't
drama.
Don't watch Gerald's
Game.
Don't
talk to me about your drama.
Ugh, worst.
So, flash forward, Laura tells Virginia about the murder. She's really eager to be like, you know what happened in this hotel?
30 years ago.
Murder. And so
murder.
She says that, but Earl's kind of pissed and he's like, don't get her all worked up. She can't handle it because that's
got
how you
anxiety.
Treat women right back then, you know, is like, women can't handle anything. Don't talk to them about anything.
No.
So the way that she is treated by both of these men drives me crazy.
Oh, I know.
Oh, don't even.
Good call. She's got anxiety. She just needs to like chill out a little bit and have some support.
Oh, but there is a scene later that we'll talk about where Sadie calls it and is like, this is what he's going to say because this is how men treat women who have mm-hmm. any kind of thought or emotion. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so Virginia can sense the ghost, we find out. She can kind of feel that something is in the room.
She's touched.
She's got the shining. And
ooh.
So, and Buck decides he wants to have a little fun mm-hmm. because they've just been arguing the whole time on their 30-year anniversary. Mm-hmm. So Earl and Laura May are going to go have an affair, apparently. So they just wander off. Mm-hmm. And Virginia has these crazy dreams. Then we flash back to Laura May's room, which this was my favorite part of the whole short story. Laura May has this insane room where
it's like the coolest art project ever.
It's an installation.
Yes.
She's curated basically an entire 30 years of finding anything that people have left behind mm-hmm. in hotels.
And cataloging.
She's numbered them and placed them on the shelves, and it's anything and everything. Trash to, I mean, everything.
I would 1,000,000% go see that installation.
I loved, loved, loved this idea yeah. about somebody who has worked in a hotel, like on the side of a road in the middle of nowhere, collecting anything and everything that's been left behind oh, and cataloging it.
I have left some interesting stuff in hotels.
Oh, I loved this whole premise. Mm. But so she starts showing it to him, and he's kind of like, ooh, she's a little off a rocker, but she's kind of sweet with them jeans. And so then she pulls out the bottom drawer. She has a little key around her neck and opens it up, and it turns out to be the .38 that Sadie had shot Buck with, that the cops never found because he tossed it in a bush, and she was like 5 at the time or something and ran and grabbed it and has had it the whole time. And it's still loaded, by the way.
Cool, cool.
Surprise. So then the ghosts have some foreplay, I guess. They're, you know, like whatever. And Sadie wants none of it. She's like, get off me. You're gross, because he's got a big old bullet hole in his chest and he's bleeding on her.
Yep.
He's really forceful and disgusting. And then Virginia sees and hears him. She's like, what's going on? Because I should back up. The driver, Earl, and the couple, the preacher and his wife, have adjoining rooms that have a door that can be opened up between mm-hmm. them. And she hears it in the other room. So she goes in there.
So it's technically happening in Earl's room, but Earl's not there.
He's
because
off with Laura May.
He's having a moment with Laura May.
Yeah, so she freaks out because she hears it and drops all her pills. And that's
not
right,
her pills.
Yeah, and John walks in and is like, oh, you're disgusting. Look at you down here. I thought
look
we
at you managing your mental health issues.
Yeah, how dare you? And it's really kind of a rough little scene there.
Yeah.
And then he gets pissed. John is like, not again. Earl's making a fool of me. He's trying to ruin my entire ministry.
Yeah.
He's working for the devil.
Well, I mean, in fairness, this guy's a little tightly wound. His wife is, from his point of view, drugging it up. And his married assistant is off humping.
Sure.
So I could see where a tightly wound person might overreact here.
Well, he does.
I mean, not to this degree, but
he runs out because now the storm's coming down, and he mm-hmm. starts just yelling and looking for him, and realizes the only place he could conceivably be in this weather is in the front office.
Laura May's bedroom.
Yeah. And so he goes in there and he's looking for Earl, leaving Buck with Virginia alone in the hotel room. So the ghost, the creepy mm-hmm. ghost, is now alone with the preacher's wife. Buck starts like copping a feel and molesting her a little, and he's like, I'm just in your imagination.
Yeah, this is all dumb.
It was so dumb. While John breaks into Laura May's room and drags Earl out and is like, you're working for the devil.
Yeah, a post-coital drag around.
Calls Laura a whore and, you know, all this kind
of
stuff.
Let's just kind of zip through this.
And Sadie now is watching, the other ghost is watching this like a soap opera. She's like, oh, this is interesting. Mm-hmm. I got nothing better going on.
Honestly, if you're a ghost, go to a hotel and have a look around.
Yeah, it's all very dramatic. Then Laura May grabs the gun and goes after the preacher because she's like, oh, hell no, I had my way with that boy and he's mine now. So she's like, you get your hands off of him, and starts running
she
out.
She pops
there.
Her teeth back in. Yeah,
totally. She puts her straw hat on and is like, oh, no. Oh, hell no.
Yeah, and so she runs out there.
So she goes after there. Meanwhile, I just wrote Buck needs a Viagra because Virginia's like, he couldn't do anything to me because he can't get it because
she's berating him.
Yeah, because she's not afraid of him, so he's not turned on. Like,
okay.
He can't do the deed because she's not like fearful of him.
I had some issues here because also his chest has been shot out, so he's probably not able to pump blood and probably can't, like, I mean.
Sure. That's practical.
Thank you. Yeah. Okay. Anyway.
It probably applies in the ghost world, too.
Well, I mean, if he can't sustain, you know.
Yeah.
Rise to the occasion is the, I don't, I'm sorry.
Yeah, you didn't have to. I mean, people get it.
Whatever.
So there's a lot of drama in the rain. Virginia, so she hears a shot. She runs out there thinking her husband's been shot, but it isn't the case. There's like somebody's in the mud and rolling around. There's drama, drama, drama. And then she sees the gun there. Virginia grabs the gun and goes back to shoot Buck, the ghost, because that's her brilliant idea.
That's real dumb because he's already been shot. I already been shouting.
But then, she takes aim at Buck and is like, whatever, and then shoots him. But it goes, shocker, it goes through the ghost.
What?
And hits her husband in the neck, who's standing there in the doorway, and kills him. And then she sits down and is like, I'm going to shoot myself. But then Sadie appears and is like, don't do it. You're going to be a celebrity. You're going to be famous for doing what you did.
You're going to be famous?
Yeah.
That's better than death.
And she's like, yeah, you know what? That's true. And Sadie's like, just plead insanity. Be as crazy as you can. And then she decides that's a good idea, walks out. The sheriff's there being like, put your gun down or whatever. She throws a gun out, looks up. There's like a moon. She looks at the moon and the story ends.
That's so dumb.
And that's Revelations. This was a weak one.
Yep. Let's move on. Let's continue quickly.
Yeah, we should probably wrap it up because we're getting close to the end here.
Okay.
Down Satan, we can do very quick.
Yep.
That's the fourth story. It's like a few pages. Bizarre little story about a millionaire named Gregorius.
Ah, yes.
Who felt God had forsaken him. He is insanely wealthy. And he decides he's going to summon the devil so that God will intervene, and that's how he'll be able to talk with God again, is if he can, like,
obviously
put himself in that situation. So he constructs what he decides is going to be hell on earth, known as New Hell. This is very Clive Barker.
Hell 2.
Yeah.
Hell squared.
In Africa, of all places.
Oh.
And waits. And then years pass because he doesn't really hear anything. Nothing happens. Although he gets indications.
Like little hooves trotting through the hallways of Hell 2.
Little things. And this is one of the only times I wrote down a quote.
I know what
I'm going to write. He writes that he originally thinks Satan is there and hiding because, quote, wasn't that his fingerprint on the door handle? His turd on the stairs?
It was his turd. It was Satan's turd.
The turd on the stairs thing is turd. Just sprinkled in there as though we're supposed to just keep reading and not even notice it.
If you write the word turd, you want to be noticed.
I laughed out loud.
Me too.
I'm reading on the train like I always am, and I'm thinking nobody knows that I just read that Satan took a dump on somebody's staircase.
Left a turd.
So there you go. Eventually the cops come like years later and discover that hundreds of people have been lured into this massive, it's like, seven palaces big or something. Basically he tried to recreate based on texts and stuff, hell.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody's like pinned up on the wall and being tortured and burning and everything else.
Hold on. As you said, based on texts, my 21st century mind imagine text messages.
Oh, how quickly we've changed. And the premise is essentially that he's become kind of a demon.
He's Satan himself.
By waiting around for angels to come get him.
Mm-hmm.
That's down Satan. It's a strange little tale.
It's weird. I mean, there's a turd on a stair.
That's the takeaway.
Yep.
That's what I would have called it, was a turd on a stair.
Oh,
Satan's turd.
Where else would you find a turd?
And then the last one you can take.
Age of Desire.
The Angel of Desire.
No, it's Age.
Oh, is it Age?
Age
okay.
of Desire. So.
I just.
There's the book. Look at it.
Yeah.
Okay. So this is actually, it's pretty long, but it's very easy to condense. So there are. We start out with two security guards and a laboratory that is obviously testing on primates and stuff.
Doesn't it start, though, with a guy like on fire running out?
Absolutely not important to the story.
Oh, okay.
So just ignore that. Obviously, they're testing on primates and they discover the body of a female scientist who we later learn is named Dr. Dance. She's been torn apart, like her chest has been torn open and she's been sexually assaulted. Her male scientist partner, who we learn later is named Dr. Wells, he survives. He's actually attacked by one of the security guards who thinks he was the attacker of
the assailant.
Yep. But it wasn't him. So the scientists were working on something. It was a project called Blind Boy, and it was like a secret project that nobody else in their little area knew about.
Well, it was Blind Boy. Nobody would see it coming.
Yep. And there's a whole lot of buildup about the backstory of the cops who are working, and it super doesn't matter to the story. So they do review, the police review a tape of the last experiment they were doing within this Blind Boy project.
Did you hear monkey sounds as you were reading this?
No.
Okay.
Well, only later. You'll see.
I'll see.
There is a tape of their last experiment. So yes. They review it. And in the video, the doctor, Dance or Wells, I don't know which one, they inject their test subject, a guy named Jerome, with something. Who knows what? And at first, they're asking him, how are you feeling? What's going on? He's like, normal, nothing. I'm just a dude here to collect my $40 for participating in your weird experiment.
Been there, done that, right?
Oh, yeah. So many.
So many times.
Hair growth serums on my arms. No. So they ask him a bunch of questions, ask him how it makes him feel. Nothing happens. And then he smiles. There's a visible change that begins to happen. He's smiling, and then he stands up, and then he begins French kissing the window of the room that he's in. And then he starts to sweat and tear out the electrodes. And so Dr. Dance is like, wait, no, keep those electrodes on. She goes to him, and that's when he attacks her. And so we know he's the one who killed her and raped her and all of that. And then we flash to another scene where, well, first of all, I should say, we know that this character is named Jerome, but the doctors don't know his name because he was anonymous on the tape. So they're now on a manhunt for this weirdo.
Yeah, I kind of always love when I'm in the know,
mm-hmm.
You know, and I'm like, dude, you guys are stupid. I know
you're
who it is.
You're bumbling. It's Jerome.
It's Jerome. Everybody knows that by now.
Jerome. Okay, so Jerome wakes up in his room.
Which we all knew. It's Jerome.
Obviously. He wakes up. He's hungry. He's very sore. His body's all beat up and scratched and cut and everything hurts. And he's like, well, I'm hungry. I'm going to turn on some music and get going with my day. He turns on the music and he starts listening to it, and the lyrics like speak to him. And
yeah, it's like, come a chameleon.
And then he's like, actually, I'm extremely aroused right now, and I'm going to go out and get after it. So he's very in the mood, and basically we spend the next 30 pages. I'm going to just...
Flash
scoot
forward.
Through this, and he's
give me time
basically trying to sexually assault anything and everything he comes across. So the idea is that he's like aroused by everything, women, men, a wall,
Satan's turds.
Nope, just a wall. No, none of Satan's turds are in this. But
given the opportunity, he might have been.
But he does hump a wall.
A wall?
You know, like a wall.
He's kind of based on reality.
He hurts himself.
Sure.
Doing it.
That happens.
But basically, he's trying to get at the heart of people.
Look at that brick there. Brick's looking really good right now.
Look at that crack.
Look at that crack. I'm gonna go hump the crack between those two freaks.
So that's exactly what he does.
Yeah.
And then when he's attacking humans, he feels their heart beating and he wants to get at it. And he is filled with a sensation of extreme attraction and love, and he just wants to get into people or things or everything, like the sky, the plants, everything. He's just, it's all working for him. And so So the world is available to him in his personal opinion. And
he sounds like a raver. Do you remember ravers? Like, they were like that. Okay. They were like, oh, I just want to be part of everything. And I'm feeling really sexy right now.
Yeah,
I'm
it like, was okay. Sort of like that, but super extreme.
But without the pacifier necklace.
And also murder.
Oh, yeah.
Add murder. Replace pacifier necklace and orb dancing with murder.
But would the knife have a glow stick at the end?
Obviously.
Okay.
Okay. So he's...
I know the type.
The long story short here, Dr. Wells comes to after being beaten by the security guards. And we learn that this is all his idea. Like, he wants the world to come to an end via... humping. And so he's also been experimenting on all of the primates in his lab. Those guys are all humping each other and whatever. And it's basically freak till you bleed and die. So all the...
Was the song playing the Humpty Dance?
No.
Okay.
So all the monkeys start dying off because they're not eating. And actually, it made me think of this animal in...
Monkey shines.
No, in New Zealand, that it's a type of shrew, and it does that. The males, like, mate and mate and mate obsessively until they die. They they just, like, freak out and procreate and then die because they neglect all of their other needs.
Wow.
So it's basically exactly that, but... something that you can inject. So the monkeys are showing like they're fatigued. They've had their fill, but they can't stop. So they keep going until they die. Dr. Wells comes in and he's trying to cover it up and he's killing monkeys, but hot on his tail is Jerome, who's come back to the source. And he's upset about the killing of the monkeys for whatever reason, which is weird because they're all dying anyway. And it seems kind of like a mercy. And then the cops are behind Jerome because he was, you know, sexually assaulting everyone and everything between here and there. And the cop, like, confronts him, and he basically is like, well, I'm going to die. I humped till I died. And then he dies standing up. The end.
Okay, there's a couple things. One, speaking of the Humpty Dance,
mm-hmm.
You know what I found today?
What?
A copy of Nothing But Trouble
on VHS. I saw that on Instagram.
I really love that movie.
Yeah, it's a good one.
Okay, so...
Is that 80s?
Yeah.
Let's watch
it. It's gotta be, right? Chevy Chase, Dan Aykroyd?
It seems like it, but what if it's like 1990?
What if we scratch out 1990 and write 1989?
Yeah, I like it.
And then the other thing is, do you remember on Wayne's World when Garth is just like walking and humping as he's walking to Foxy Lady?
Gross, yes.
That's what I imagine this character in this story to be doing at all times. Like,
kinda.
He just can't, he like looks down and he's just like pelvic thrusting.
I feel, nonstop. Yeah, I feel like he just pelvic thrusted from one thing to the next throughout this book. So that was an awkward read, honestly. I was like, do I have to be the one to talk about this?
You did, yeah. And good job.
Thanks.
Way to go. Way to take one for the team.
Thank you.
So that's The Inhuman Condition by Clive Barker.
Uh-huh.
It's a little bit longer episode. Sorry about that. This might be our longest episode
what?
Yet.
What?
Yeah.
Are we at 3 hours?
About 3 hours right now, clocking in. It's like a Lord of the Rings
movie. 7 hours, 22 minutes.
But, you know, it was a long book, too, and to get through. But I enjoyed it. This was my first read. I think there were some hits and misses, but also considering this is a 6-volume set of, like, tons of short stories, that's bound to happen. There are a few in there that I really did enjoy a lot.
Yeah. For sure. It's worth a read. It's takes little to no time to get through.
Yeah. It's an easy read, and it's interesting. It's clever. And
I like the creativity. Obviously, not all of it was like my cup of tea, but
yeah,
I appreciate that he was trying some new things and not really afraid to push those boundaries.
I would actually say I liked his writing more than his creativity. I thought he was a good writer. Like it.
Okay.
He had a way of... relaying information and setting up a kind of world to be in mm-hmm. that was pretty easy to get into. I didn't struggle to get into it at all.
Yeah, it definitely felt like all of these could be happening in the Clive Barker world simultaneously.
Yeah, for sure.
Not in our reality, but in his.
Yeah, which is, I think, the case with everything he mm-hmm. does.
Yeah, I think that's a good... He knows his brand.
Well, that's it. That's the episode. That was pretty interesting. I don't know what we're doing next week. We'll figure it out.
Yep.
But this one was fun. And we've got another book picked out already, which we're not going to reveal yet. But it's... Don't worry, it's not a children's book, but we are itching to get back to the children's books, especially after things like this. But if you like what you heard and you want to let people know, we'd be very happy about that.
Yeah.
Thanks to everybody who's been rating and reviewing and following us on social media. You can find us on iTunes and Spotify and Podbean. You can find us on Instagram at LaserGraves. And I'm on Instagram at EK Wimmer, and you are...
At Mariah Rose Wimmer.
Yeah, and so track us down. We're posting some fun stuff on Instagram.
Share with a friend, please.
Yeah, let people know, because we are... Oh, this is our 20th episode.
Whoop, whoop.
That's kind of a big one. Well, technically speaking, who knows what we're at now, but this is the 20th published episode, so...
Mm-hmm.
How about that?
There it is.
And we'll be back next week with a brand new episode, like every Tuesday. And yeah, spread the word. And
thank you for
spread
listening.
Spread the love, and hope you enjoyed it. Okay, bye.
Bye.